Ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon and welcome. I am Jonathan Parrish and I have the privilege of welcoming you to this book presentation. Now, in a few moments, I shall ask Dr. Thomas Reed to introduce his latest book, Cyber War Will Not Take Place. But I should like to start by thanking Isabel Fernandez, from NATO's Public Diplomacy Division for having organised today's event. And Isabel, you could not have chosen a more appropriate nor timely subject. In today's online version of the Financial Times, one of the main headlines is, US says China is stepping up cyber war. Last week, the NATO Secretary General visited the US Cyber Command at Fort Meade in Maryland. And that was just a couple of days after a Syrian group hacked into the Twitter account of the Associated Press and issued a false tweet about a double explosion at the White House and an injury to the president. That tweet caused the US stock market to drop by 1% in a matter of seconds, and the market lost nearly $140 billion in value. Thankfully, the market stabilized within 7 minutes after notification was made that the tweet was bogus. But this attack once again highlighted the potential consequences of a cyber attack. So, what is the cyber threat? What are our cyber vulnerabilities? And will a cyber war take place? There is no one better placed to answer those questions than Dr. Thomas Reed. He is currently a reader in war studies at King's College in London. And despite his young age, he has a lengthy, varied, and international academic background. He was a visiting scholar at the Hebrew University and the Shalem Center in Jerusalem. He was a non-resident fellow at the Center for Transatlantic Relations and a public policy scholar at the Woodrow Wilson Center in the United States. He's worked at the School for Advanced International Studies and at the RAND Corporation in Washington, as well as at the Institut Français des Relations Internationales in Paris. He has also worked at the Stiftung Wissenschaft und Politik, which is the German government's foreign policy think tank in Berlin. He has published numerous articles on security matters and is a frequent commentator on current affairs for major TV channels such as the BBC, CNN, and Sky. On top of all that, he even finds time to write books. His first book was about war and media operations. His second was about irregular war in the information age, and his third was about counterinsurgency. Now, I'm delighted that Dr. Reed accepted Isabel's invitation to come here today and to talk about this, his fourth book, Cyber War Will Not Take Place. After his talk, we will have the opportunity to ask questions and then to join him in the library, where we will be able to enjoy a drink and buy his book at a specially reduced price. Dr. Reed, over to you.
Press a button here as well. Wonderful. I thank you, Jonathan, very much for this overly generous introduction, and also to Isabel for organizing this event today. I'll try to be very brief, something like 20 minutes, to have a longer question and answer session. So let me quickly switch to my presentation here. Sorry, this was too fast. Okay. I think we should start by looking at this idea of cyber war for a moment. Jonathan mentioned that I'm in the Department of War Studies at King's College. And of course, some of you may know the department. It's the biggest center for the study of conflict, really, on the globe. We have 250 PhD students these days, so we are truly an intellectual powerhouse these days. And naturally, if you have people sitting next door who are writing books about the Somme, you tend to be somewhat cautious when you use the word cyber war, because after all, let's remember, nobody has ever been physically harmed, let alone killed, by a cyber attack. Only one cyber attack on record has ever damaged machine, Stuxnet. So the case studies on the high end of the violent end of the scale are very few and far between. So let's get this notion of war out of the way very quickly, because the fundamental point of departure of the book is that calling the problem cyber war is a distraction from some of the more fundamental, it's distracting and framing the problem in a way that makes it more difficult to do something about it. So if when would it make sense to speak about war? I'll take a very conservative approach to war. An act is, we can define an act as a use of force, or an act of war in certain circumstances, if you like, if it is at least potentially violent, and that includes the physical, must include the physical destruction or physical harm, either of machines or human beings. If it is instrumental, if somebody is trying to change somebody else's behavior in a very Clausewitzian line of thought, if, for those of you who are familiar with Clausewitz, which I presume most of you would be, given that we are at NATO here. And the third point is that an act of armed aggression, these are terms that are not synonymous, but I think it applies to all of them, must also be political. Political in the sense that somebody needs to claim credit. I did this to you in order to achieve a certain outcome. No cyber attack on record has met all of those criteria together, ever. And the book is walking through the empirical case study, empirical record in great depth. I think it's the most detailed study of the empirical record on the market right now. And here's the other fundamental assumption that I just would like to make very clear. It's now 2013, almost mid-2013. We've seen so many cyber attacks, computer network attacks, breaches, espionage cases over the past couple of years, but especially in the year 2012, that I think the fictional discussion about, you know, so many texts have many mays and coulds and woulds in them when they talk about cyber war, that I sometimes lose patience. We have an empirical record, and it's a rich empirical record to talk about. And we have also a technological environment that we need to consider that can sometimes be quite technical. So if somebody talks lots of woulds but doesn't go into technical depth, I think that's a problematic sign. If you sense a certain frustration here, it's because I just try to review a book manuscript yet again, because I get sent book manuscripts and peer-reviewed articles all the time now, since I published this book. And to be honest, I'm quite shocked sometimes by the quality of the discussions. And I'm sure that many of you who may be operators will sometimes see publications and just wonder what the relationship to reality is here. So we absolutely need to be very thorough when we speak about cyber attacks of any kind, and that's what the book is trying to do. The core argument of the book is that once we look at cyber attacks in their three dimensions, if you like. So what are the three dimensions, very quickly? Cyber attacks, and I'm excluding crime here, I'm only looking at political types of computer attacks. Let's keep crime out. For cyber attacks fall into three main sets. Sabotage, which tries to put it bluntly, damage machines or processes. These can be administrative processes as well. So it's about withdrawing efficiency from a process. Not necessarily through damage, but oftentimes damage is a means to that end. So first we have sabotage. Second, we have espionage, which is basically self-explanatory. Espionage, both politically and commercially speaking. And the third dimension of cyber attacks is subversion, what I call subversion, so hacktivism. Mobilizing militancy online or just some sort of activism online, which covers a lot of ground and catches a lot of different phenomena, but it's a separate problem from espionage and sabotage. Now, if we look at all of those three, sabotage, espionage, and subversion, we see not more violence, but less violence as a result and in the context of computer attacks. That's the fundamental argument. So let me quickly spell that out very briefly. In the context of cyber attacks help diminish rather than accentuate violence in three different ways. First, in the context of sabotage, it's now possible to directly target systems without their human operators. So one example would be targeting an air defense system, which actually happened in Israel in 2007, rather in Syria, the Israelis in Syria in 2007. We don't know the details of that case, but what happened is that an act of sabotage was able to affect a machine without affecting their human operators. Now, the alternative would have been to use some sort of airstrike, possibly an anti-radiation missile, which would have blown up the air defense system and possibly harmed human beings in the process. Now it's become easier to distinguish between that kind of violence and a non-violent disruption. That's the first dimension. Second dimension is, in the context of espionage, that it's now possible to exfiltrate information, to exfiltrate data from a target without necessarily infiltrating human agents first. And that's a general statement, but if we I walk through a number of case studies and examples. So again, in the context of espionage of intelligence operations, we also see a clearer division of labor between SIGINT and HUMINT, if you like. It's I'll talk about that in a moment in some more detail. And finally, in the realm of subversion, it may be becoming less mobilizing militancy, if you like, may be becoming less reliant on direct action and political violence. So the goal of subversion, of course, is to undermine established authority. Violence, in the traditional context, was a means to that end. I think it's increasingly possible to undermine established authority in a non-violent way, also through by using new technologies and innovative fashions. Now, that's the argument. And the spirit of the entire analysis is one of skepticism, also vis-a-vis this argument. What I mean by that is, if I say we see less violence as a result of cyber attacks, then what's really most interesting is to look at the limitations of where the limits are of that new phenomenon. And in fact, the limits are quite, this new phenomenon is very constrained. So what I'll do now, because I really want to keep this very short, is I'll give you a few thoughts on weaponized code and the use of cyber weapons, I think, which is could be interesting in the context of your work, and especially at the limitations of weaponized code. So in the following three or four slides, I'm basically discussing the major examples of the use of weaponized computer code. And the biggest example that everybody has on their mind usually when we talk about these cases is, of course, Stuxnet. Is there anybody in the audience who doesn't know what Stuxnet was? I'm happy to introduce Stuxnet if you want me to. But I think I can assume that you all know the Stuxnet story, the use of it was a very sophisticated piece of malware that was designed to delay the Iranian nuclear enrichment program in Natanz. I think a couple of things are notable about the execution of this operation. I'll just name two here, just to keep it simple. The first is the operation was remarkable for, yes, the skill that the developers put into the development of this piece of software, but most important, but the skill wasn't the bottleneck. A lot of countries, a lot of organizations even have the skill to do something like that, but not a lot of organizations have the intelligence, the target intelligence that is needed in order to build this software. So Stuxnet had highly specific parameters about the targeted control systems built into it, which is the reason why it didn't cause any collateral damage, if you like. It caused a lot of collateral infections on approximately 100,000 nodes, computers, but it didn't cause any. The payload didn't actually work on the vast majority of those computers, except on those computers inside Natanz that controlled the specific centrifuge configuration that the software was programmed to harm. I won't go into describing technically in detail how it did that. It's in the book, and you probably read it in the media somewhere. It's well covered. So the first thing I'd like to mention is it was an intelligence, the intelligence for the operation was the bottleneck. That was the difficult thing to get in order to do the operation. And in fact, we don't really know exactly, we don't know very much about the intelligence gathering operation that predated the development of Stuxnet. The second feature that I'd like to mention here is on that slide, it's the timescale. Stuxnet, the development, we now know since a couple of months ago, the Symantec updated its time estimate. The development started probably sometime in 2005, possibly even earlier. And the operation continued until 2012, for almost 7 years in total, precisely. Something like 1 month less than 7 years, as far as we know. Now, that's the opposite of one of those lightning-fast cyber attacks that the media like to talk about. It's a seven-year campaign. It took longer than the Second World War, if you like. So it was cyber attacks, and it came in multiple versions, and it developed over time. It's a very important thing to note. Now, let me give you the argument that I'm making in the chapter on weaponized code, on cyber weapons. If you want to maximize the destructive potential of a piece of software, then you are likely to observe a double effect. On the one hand, maximizing the destructiveness will significantly increase the resources needed to develop the software. It will increase the intelligence needed to develop the software. So resources, intelligence, and time required to get it right. That may extend into the actual operation itself. But by maximizing the destructive potential, if you like, you are likely to decrease the number of targets that the piece of software is designed for, because there's a technical reason for that. You are likely to decrease also collateral damage because it's more targeted. And you're likely, more politically thinking, you're likely to decrease the political utility of that tool. Why? Because, again, war, acts of violence, political violence in general, are designed to change behaviors. And the Stuxnet, in fact, also was designed to change the Iranians' behavior. Now, if you want to change somebody's behavior through an act of force, chances are you may have to repeat that. You do it once and say, okay, if you don't do what I want you to do, I'll do it again. I'll do something slightly different. I'll increase the level of pain for you. In the case of a highly targeted software sabotage operation, it's very questionable that you can repeat it for a number of reasons. One is because vulnerabilities that you used in order to attack in the first place may be exposed. In this case, a number of Windows vulnerabilities, and then the system is likely to be patched rather quickly, actually. So patching stands in the way of repeatability, for instance. There are other dynamics along those lines. Also because the target is likely to shut down the access points. And try to, in an attempt to minimize risk exposure, etc. So bottom line is, weaponized code is actually far more limited if we look at the empirical cases that are available than we like to think. The reason for that, this analysis is somewhat problematic, but it's the best we can do. Why is it problematic? Because we have so few case studies. There's so few operations that actually caused physical harm in this realm of computer attacks. There's Stuxnet, there's the potential use of a computer attack to blind the Syrian air defense system that I mentioned. There is a sabotage attack in Siberia in 1982 where the against a pipeline, a CIA attack against a Russian pipeline. But the facts are quite difficult to establish on that one. I tried to consult all the sources, and it doesn't hold up. There is there's an event in Queensland, Australia, where an insider spilled a lot of sewage through a SCADA attack. I'm just giving you some examples, but these are basically the main examples that are out there. So it's a problematic empirical record for a couple of reasons, which in a way doesn't reflect the immense public interest in the subject and the fear really out there. And people who are tasked to develop cyber weapons, I take it, confront a somewhat difficult situations because the political expectation in different countries seems to be that because of the media coverage that we can do something, we can say in Libya or possibly in Syria, you can actually paralyze your enemy's air defense systems or even more than that, perhaps infrastructure through cyber attacks. But if you're actually tasked to develop these types of weapons, I think people are discovering that it's actually not as easy as their political masters seem to think. I'll leave it at that. I'll close and then open for the Q&A by mentioning one more example that, to bring it back to my main argument about less violence. I think the most sophisticated, not sophisticated, I'm sorry, the most consequential computer attack that we've seen so far in the commercial arena, perhaps almost as consequential as Stuxnet for the actual company involved, was an attack against Saudi Aramco in August 2012, when unknown attackers deleted the files on 30,000 computers in that company. That's the equivalent of 75% of all of the company's computers. Basically, the business network, the company's internal network, was affected, not the oil production, which is also computer-controlled, of course, but it's a different, technically speaking, it's a different type of network. It's an ICS network, an industrial control system network. That was not affected, although the attackers apparently tried to affect it, but they didn't succeed. Now, it's an interesting case study on its own, but it's especially interesting because it was a non-violent act. It deleted data, actually overwrote master boot records, so technically speaking, it didn't even delete data, but de facto, data were not available to people working on those machines. But it was non-violent. No machine was physically damaged, let alone also no human being was physically harmed in any way, but it was highly efficient. So that's an interesting case, especially for a military organization or really anybody thinking about this problem hard, because it is, in contrast to the early 20th century, when sabotage, you know, when you basically were, say, you sabotage originates in labor confrontations as an expression, as an idea, in labor confrontations in the early 20th century, late 19th century. So if you were pouring sand into a machine in order to sabotage the machine, which actually happened, le sabot, you know, the wooden shoe, that's the symbol, throwing a wooden shoe into a machine. Where do you draw the line between violence and nonviolence in such a context? It's actually very difficult to do. Sand was creating physical damage, but now the sand is software, and it is not creating physical damage, but the outcome is ultimately comparable. So that's an interesting new dynamic that we are observing. I could just go on like this for a very long time, and you would be bored very quickly, so I'd rather stop here, and if you're interested, we can expand on any details in the Q&A.
I can assure you that if Thomas were to continue, you would not be bored, because the book is fascinating, and he gives a whole range of examples of cyber attacks in the three domains that he specifically mentioned there, espionage, sabotage, and subversion. Now, as the moderator, I have the privilege of being able to ask the first question. And I'm going to. Because, Thomas, towards the end of your book, you talk about the problem of attribution. Who did this attack? And you state that the problem of finding the attribution, or making that attribution, is going to be more political than technical. Now, how do you think we can resolve those political problems associated with attribution of cyber attacks?
So the attribution question, as I suppose most people in the room appreciate, is one of the most intricate and difficult questions in this context. So the attribution question is, who did it? Actually, it's more than just who did it. The question is, what was it? How did it happen? When did it happen? When did it stop happening? Who did it? And ultimately, also, why was it done? It's all part of the attribution question. And it's a technical question, yes, as is usually assumed, because mostly computer scientists and people working in forensics are dealing with it to find traces that implicate somebody. But it's also a political question. Why is it a political question? Because if we are, say, if a political entity, a state or an organization within a state that has a political motivation, is engaging in some sort of attack, it can be espionage or sabotage or something else, then they are likely to, they oftentimes want to remain unattributed, especially in the case of intelligence operations. Nobody wants to essentially tell the world that they're trying to gather intelligence in another country through a computer attack. Now, it's political because, say, if you are if you're a security company like Symantec or VeriSign or something like that, and you're looking to trace an attack to its perpetrator, chances are that so one thing that you do if you do that is you look at log files on computers, and also log files from ISPs, from internet service providers like BT or what's the biggest ISP in this country? I don't even know. Okay. So they have log files, these companies, about who used their computers at what time. And if an attack originated from another country, naturally you would need the log files, I'm simplifying here, from an internet service provider in that country. Now, if a country doesn't have the legislative framework, or more importantly, if some powerful political entity in a specific country doesn't want to reveal these forensic data, then you're basically in a dead end. You can't trace the trail back to its origin. Now, it's political because, say, if a very serious computer attack would actually happen, I don't think a cyber 9/11 is a terribly realistic scenario, but let's just assume it would happen for a moment, then the political stakes would be so high that a country that would say, well, these attacks originated from two of our universities, but I'm sorry, we can't help you, that in a political high-pressure situation like post 9/11, so to speak, would not become a politically tenable situation anymore. But that's pushing the debate into the fictional realm, and I'd rather not do that. But it shows us how the problem is political. I'm evading your question. The very simple question, can we solve the political side of the attribution problem? The very short answer is, it depends on the case.
Thank you very much. Right, your turn. Who would like to ask a question? Isabel, are you going to come around with the microphone? Could I ask that you introduce yourself and say where you work and what you do before asking your question to Thomas?
Good afternoon, Thomas, and thank you very much for your interesting speech. My name's Jonathan Dowdle. I'm from the UK delegation here. Two quick points. A question about median, or medium, if you will. Some define cyberspace as a global commons, much like airspace, land, and other mediums which we fight warfare. You're clearly skeptical about that, so how do you define the median of cyberspace? Is it instead a commercial question, for example, because they're owned by private companies like the ones you just referenced, or is it a public health issue because viruses Analogies have been used by Microsoft, for example, that what we need is to inoculate our systems with antivirus software. So how do you define that question? And secondly, looking at your skepticism about the ability to develop weaponized code, for example, conventional military stockpiles do not duplicate to the power of two every 2 years. By Moore's law, computer processing does. So does that mean that your skepticism could be outpaced by the sheer rate of advanced computer networks? Thank you.
I'll take those in reverse order. The question about skepticism being outpaced by technology is an excellent one. Actually, yes. So for instance, the developments in the weaponized code arena are, the fact that we have so few case studies that actually deserve to be analyzed in that lens means that something could happen that would change our analysis fundamentally. And one thing that could happen, which hasn't happened yet, is among computer scientists, this is highly controversial. I would like to preface this. We could see a software that is malicious, that is able to operate in an isolated environment without pre-programmed parameters. In other words, a software that is able to learn about vulnerabilities and engage with those vulnerabilities without having the precise parameters being pre-programmed into it, like Stuxnet. But that raises a number of development questions that we obviously can't discuss in this context. And I couldn't, frankly, discuss them because I lack the precise knowledge. But clearly, things could happen that would change the analysis. That's the nature of this subject, of course. But that doesn't mean we can just let our imagination flow freely, which happens far too often, I think. The other question you're raising about the domain, called it commons, indeed, those are slightly different comparisons that are often used, the commons as opposed to the domain thinking. I think they both have in common that they are metaphors. I think the internet, certainly if calling the internet the fifth domain of warfare, like air forces sometimes like to do, because that means they're in charge, basically, that's using a metaphor. Even what I'm doing when I say weaponized code is using a metaphor in a way. And metaphors are seductive. Sometimes metaphors seduce ourselves. They're useful didactically. They help us explain things. Like when I say to you, I sometimes use that example, that cybersecurity is a conceptual minefield. Then you know, be careful. And you may want to think about how to avoid the mines, so it makes you creative too. But it's also deceiving because we may not understand when a comparison breaks down, because they all break down at some point. They're imperfect. And we need technical expertise to see that point when they break down. So the less technical expertise you have, the more careful I would be with comparisons like that.